It's good to be back here in Indiana, the hay fever capital of the world. And that's bothering me a little bit this morning, so if I kind of give out once in a while or if I start crying, it's not because I get so caught up in my message, it's because of the hay fever. So you don't have to cry with me. We're going to be speaking this morning from Genesis 31. And the title of my sermon is Suspect Thy Neighbor as Thyself. You know, things are not always as they appear to be. There was a cowboy one time riding across the desert, and he came up on this Indian with his ear down on a wagon trail. And the cowboy walked over and he looked down at him, and the Indian said, "Big wagon, man smoking pipe, woman wearing blue dress and bonnet, two horses, one white, one black." And the cowboy looked at him and he said, "That's absolutely incredible. You mean you can tell all that just by listening to that wagon trail?" And he looked up at him and he said, "No, ran over me about a half hour ago." Things aren't always as they appear to be. There's what's commonly used as a benediction in Genesis, and it is, "The Lord watch between me and thee as long as we are apart from each other." Now that's been used over and over again as a benediction in different churches. It's been used between close friends and lovers as they part, so that they have this sort of close bond here by using this. The Mizpah benediction. And that's what Mizpah means. "The Lord watch between me and thee as long as we are apart from each other." It's not really a benediction at all, though. In the context, it's actually a malediction of mistrust. What it really means is, remember that God's got his eye on you because I don't trust you as far as I can throw you. And we want to look at that story this morning. It's the story of Jacob and Laban. Back in Genesis 29, we get the story of Jacob leaving Palestine and going back to his grandfather's people. He goes back to, apparently the area is Haran. He goes back to that area and he meets some shepherds. And they're gathered around a well. This beautiful young woman comes up, who is Rachel. He finds out that she is his cousin. He's delighted to find out that she is the one that he is coming to see, or her father is the one he's coming to see. He kisses her and pushes back the entrance to the well, shows off his manly strength, which young men are wont to do, and impresses Rachel. And then she takes him to her father's house, to Jacob's uncle, Laban, introduces him. They have a big family reunion, a big emotional gathering there, and then Jacob stays there then for a month. Well, after a month, things begin to change. Then Laban comes up to Jacob and he says, "Jacob, I want you to work for me." And he says, I want to pay you." That was generous of him. And all through here we're going to see now, Jacob is a very tricky person. His name means supplanter. And last time I was here, I preached on Jacob and how tricky he was. And Laban was also a very tricky person. So Jacob had met his match here. And all through this story, it's a battle of one tricker against another tricker. It's kind of like a constant Halloween going on. So Laban gets this idea, or Jacob offers, and Laban loves the idea. Jacob offers to work for 7 years if he's allowed to marry Rachel. Laban's reaction is, "I'm going to marry her off to somebody anyway. It might as well be this fellow as anybody else. And 7 years free labor is not a bad deal." So Laban jumps at the chance. He says, "Fine, that sounds good." So Jacob works 7 years for Rachel, and it says that his love for her is so great that the 7 years' labor seemed as a few days. Isn't that sweet? Times have changed. After 7 years, Laban there's the big wedding and everything, and Laban takes advantage of the darkness and the oriental custom of the bride wearing a veil and pulls a switch. He puts Leah, the older sister, in instead of Rachel. Now, there have been a lot of stories written on the two-sister idea, with the younger sister being very beautiful, but the oriental custom was that the older sister had to be married off first. Well, Jacob doesn't discover the switch until the next morning. And of course, by then, it's too late. He understandably gets very upset. He goes to Laban and he says, "Laban, what have you done to me here? I worked 7 years for this beautiful, beautiful woman, and you've given me this woman that is described as having weak eyes." I'm not exactly sure what that means, but she undoubtedly wasn't quite as beautiful as Rachel. Well, Laban would have made a good used car salesman. He says, "There's something I forgot to tell you. It just slipped my mind, but see, over here in our country, we have this custom where we marry off the older daughter first. And I guess it just slipped my mind, but I just thought that you knew that, so I slipped Leah in there. You went ahead and married her, and I'm sorry, it's just been a big mistake. It was just a lack of communication." So it's a big problem in Jacob's eyes. Laban thought that everything was going to work out fine. But Laban says, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I like your looks. You're a nice young man. I'll make you a good offer. Work for me for 7 more years, and you can have Rachel." Jacob accepts. At this point, we have to start wondering about Jacob. Something is happening here. But Jacob accepts the offer. He works 7 more years for Rachel. And again, it says that the extended time, his love for her was so great that it seemed but a few days. It doesn't say about his feelings toward Leah during that time. But Leah was the unfavored one. And now he has 2 wives. One person said one time that in Bible times, people could have as many wives as they could afford. That's why we only have 1 now. Leah was the unfavored one. Rachel was the favored one. And so God looked down on this situation, and he blessed Leah. And Leah had 6 sons and several daughters. In those days, that was considered a blessing. Rachel was not the blessed one. And eventually, she did finally have a son. And so she had 1 son, and Leah had 6 sons by the time we come up to the story where we have it now. It's interesting to notice, though, that even though Leah was the unfavored one, both Jesus and David came from the lineage of Leah and not from Rachel. Well, the tricks and the treachery continue. Jacob starts feeling that he's been taken advantage of a little bit here, starts getting his eyes open, and so he starts saying, "Now, wait a minute. Now I've got 2 wives. I worked 14 years, and all I have to show for it is 2 wives." So he says, "I want something more substantial, a little more substance here, something that I can buy food with." And so they strike a deal where Jacob is going to earn, after all his work here, he's going to earn the spotted and the speckled sheep from Laban's flocks. Now, this was another good offer that Laban had. All of his sheep that had imperfections, all of the ones that he couldn't quite get a good enough price for, he offers to Jacob. Well, again, Jacob accepts the deal. It's not quite good enough for Laban, though. He takes all those sheep out of his flock and hides them so that Jacob can't have anything. Laban was totally unscrupulous. He's not playing by the rules anymore. Jacob decides he's going to try a few tricks of his own. And so he does a few things and causes the sheep to have spotted and speckled offspring. Now, we're not exactly told what happens here, but apparently God had a large hand in this and blessed Jacob by giving him these offspring. Jacob tried different tricks, and they did have spotted and speckled offspring, but I don't think that it was the tricks that Jacob did. I think God blessed Jacob. Well, after all this, Laban started changing Jacob's wages. He changed his wages 10 times. We're not exactly told if he was paid any money or what, but he changed his wages 10 times. Well, after all this, God appeared to Jacob in a dream, and he said, "Jacob, you're going to have to leave." Jacob was getting taken advantage of too much. God said, "You're going to have to get out of this area. Go back to your own country. God wanted to make a people here out of Jacob, and he said, Jacob, you've got to get away, go back to Palestine. And so in chapter 31, Jacob gathers all his belongings up, all of his wives, all of his children, all of his sheep, all of his cattle, he gathers them all up, all of his servants, and he takes off at night, and he doesn't tell anybody that he's leaving. He had finally wised up. He decided not to tell Laban that he was leaving. Well, unknown to Jacob, Rachel stole the household gods. She hid them in her stuff, and they took off at night, and Laban found out. Well, they had several days on Laban before he found out that they were gone. He gathered up all of his servants, armed and everything, armed to the teeth. They went flying after Jacob and his family. And just before they caught up with him, God appeared to Laban in a dream. And he said, tomorrow, when you come up on Jacob, don't say anything to him, whether it's good or bad. Just keep your mouth shut. Well, Jacob was going to obviously do something drastic here, but this made him think a little more rationally. He caught up with him the next day, came up, and he said, why have you stolen everything? Jacob said, why have you been so unfair to me? These people didn't trust each other at all, and for good reason. Well, Rachel had stolen the gods. Laban said, you didn't have to steal the gods. You took everything else. You didn't have to steal my household gods, my idols. Rachel had taken them. She didn't say that she took them, but she continued to hide them, and Laban didn't find them. It's interesting. Laban looks around, and he says, all this is mine. It's interesting how after 20 years' labor, Laban didn't want to give Jacob a thing. It's good Jacob got away like he did, or he wouldn't have gotten anything. What they decide to do is to put a boundary between them. So they pile up some stones, they pile up some rocks here, and they agree to this boundary. Let's read Genesis 31, verses 45 through 52. Genesis 31, verses 45 through 52. I'm going to be reading from the Revised. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there by the heap. Laban called it Jigar Sahu Datha. I'm good on those names. But Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me today. Therefore he named it Galeed. And the pillar Mizpah. For he said, the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. If you ill treat my daughters, or if you take wives beside my daughters, although no man is with us, remember, God is a witness between you and me. Then Laban said to Joseph, see this heap and the pillar, which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, but I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this heap and this pillar to me for harm. Mizpah, the beautiful benediction, is actually this result of this deep suspicion between these two men. Jacob had been used. Laban felt that he had been robbed. They couldn't trust each other at all, so they decided to have this boundary. The more you read the Bible, the more you understand that the Bible is very realistic about human nature. The Bible shows all the blemishes, all the bruises, all the flaws, all the sins. The Bible tells it like it is. There was a professor giving a test in a class one time, and he said, while you're taking this test, put one empty desk between you and the next student to avoid all appearance of evil, as the good book says. One smart aleck student raised his hand and said, what if you don't believe in the good book? The professor said, in that case, put two seats between you. The Bible is not really optimistic about human nature. There was a Sunday school student one time that asked his teacher, is man basically good or basically evil? The teacher thought about it a while and said, yes. We are basically good and we are basically evil. At best, there is a little good and a little evil in everything that we do. We have mixed motives all the time. We want to be good, and yet we want to be bad. Paul talks about this struggling within ourselves. Few people live up to their potential as children of God. A preacher got carried away, got enthusiastic during a prayer one time, and he said, oh God, forgive us our falling short. His syntax was weak, but his theology was strong. Forgive us our falling short. We do fall short of God's plan. In Romans 3 it says, all have sinned, and all have sinned. All have not sinned alike, but all alike have sinned. All of us, even in our best motives, usually have a little selfish motives behind it. We should build our foundation on God and not on mankind. Keep your finger in Genesis here. We're going to turn to Psalm 146. Psalm 146, we're going to be reading verses 3 through 5. It speaks about in whom we should put our trust. Put not your trust in princes, in a son of man, in whom there is no help. When his breath departs, he returns to his earth. On that very day, his plans perish. Happy is he whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord his God. We're told that we should not put our trust in people. We shouldn't build the foundation or the trust of our lives on people, which is very easy to do. But we should put that foundation on God. Jacob would have been penniless. He would have been completely bankrupt if he had built the foundation of his life on Jacob, if he had trusted him. Laban would have taken everything that he had. Because of human nature, we suspect our neighbor. We're not called on so much to trust our neighbor as to love him. Back in Genesis 31, beginning with verse 54, it says, and Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to eat bread. And they ate bread and tarried all night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his grandchildren and his daughters and blessed them. Then he departed and returned home. These people didn't trust each other at all. And yet they could still, when they thought rationally about things, they could still get along. We're not called so much to trust people, but we are called to love them. We can still get along cordially with people that we don't trust. Love is an interesting thing in the Christian concept. We think that Christians are somehow called to be fond of everybody. With the Christian idea of love, somehow we think that it means that Christians are supposed to overlook everybody's mistakes. We think that there's somehow a slight gullibility involved here. That somehow these simple-minded Christians are so naive that they trust anybody all the time. But actually, this Christian idea of love means partly benevolence, partly goodwill. It means trying to achieve the best for somebody else, even though they may not be a wonderful person, desiring other people's highest good. Part of it means generosity. In Matthew, Jesus calls on us to give to those who ask of you. It may have been best if the gospel writer had added the word ordinarily. Ordinarily, it's good to give to those who ask of us. But once in a while, it's not. What do we do when our children ask us for matches? Generosity has to be tempered by good sense. It has to be tempered by the true Christian idea of love, and that is desiring other people's highest good. It doesn't mean that Christians have to always be taken advantage of. Many of you know my sister Rebecca and my brother-in-law Joe. He is a minister in California. Rebecca was telling me about a story of when Joe got a call at the office, and this man said that he was, I forget exactly what story he gave, but he was down and out. He didn't have any money. He was sleeping on a park bench. He was looking for a job, though. And his only problem was he didn't have any place to take a shower. If he could take a shower and clean up, then he could probably get a job. He could have a lot better chance of getting a job. And all he needed was a place to take a shower. And that was the only break he needed. Well, he was probably trying just to have some place to clean up in his existence as a bum. But Joe, being the type of person he is, said, fine, anytime you need a shower, just call the house and let us know you're coming, and then just come on over and take a shower. Well, if you know Joe and Rebecca, you also can understand that Joe failed to mention it to Rebecca. And so one day she was home alone. The phone rang. This man said, "Hello, I'm so-and-so, and I'm ready to take a shower." Well, not knowing anything about it, she was a little flustered, naturally. She didn't like the idea of this strange man coming over and taking a shower, and he didn't come over, to make a long story short. But we have these types of stories all the time. Pastors get these calls all the time. People coming, they've got this hard luck story. They just need this slight break. They need a slight handout. They need a place to sleep for the night or whatever. There are a lot of people all the time in all kinds of situations. We have to make sure that we're generous, but we have to make sure that people don't take advantage of us. We have to also remember, though, that there is this idea of unconditional love. God loves us unconditionally. He loves us as we are. We're called upon to love other people, even those that we can't trust. We're supposed to suspect our neighbor, then. But we should also suspect ourselves. Being prudent and cautious and being careful that we're not taken advantage of can also lead to selfishness. It can also lead to holding these things for ourselves. And therefore, we should be suspicious of ourselves. When you oppose a church program because you say it will be bad for the church, suspect yourself. You may feel that it will be bad for you. When you say someone else can help that new person that came into the church, someone else can be a friend to him easier than you can, you probably won't get along that well with him. Or if you say someone else can help that person that doesn't seem to fit into the church, suspect thyself. It may be that you're scared, that you're not exactly sure what you should do, that you feel awkward in approaching that person. When your spouse comes up with some stupid idea that is totally insane, that you think is the worst thing you ever heard of, suspect thyself. It may simply be inconvenient, or you may have never done it that way before. We're all stubborn to some extent. We're all stiff-necked to some extent. We're all selfish to some extent. Every motive that we have is somehow usually a combination of good and evil. The good news is that God still loves us. I'd like to read Romans 5, verses 6 through 8. Romans 5, verses 6 through 8. While we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Why, one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good man, one will dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God doesn't always say, "I approve of you." God doesn't always like the things that we do, but God always says, "I love you." We're not always called on to trust other people, but we are called on to love them. There are always going to be people who try to make you believe that they are something other than what they really are. I work with word processing equipment. One day a woman applied for a job. She was hired for the job. She was supposed to come in, and I was supposed to train her on the equipment, although she was supposed to have a good deal of experience on the very equipment that I was supposed to train her on. So she came into the office, and I showed her the setup, and she looked at the machine, and she said, "What's that?" Immediately, I suspected that she really didn't have a lot of experience on that equipment. We'll just pretend that didn't happen. Now, from what I say here on, doesn't matter. The Christians try to do the same thing. We try to pretend that we're something that we're not. We try to gloss over the things that we do with these good motives. And we try to say, we really have the best interests of the church in mind. We really have the best interests of God in mind. But we should suspect ourselves. We should be wary of the dictator syndrome. the dictator syndrome, as we can see in examples of various dictators or dictator-type people like Hitler, Mussolini, Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, different places like that, they always have this strange idea that what is best for them is best for the country. It's easy to get into that sort of thinking. What is best for me is what is best for the church. Or what is best for me is what is best for my spouse or my friends or my other loved ones. Or what is best for me is best for that stranger over there. And it's all not because I'm selfish, but because I really have that person's interests at heart. God doesn't call on us to trust other people as much as to love them. But he also says that we're not responsible for other people's actions and other people's motives. We are responsible simply for our own.